This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, we are airing the second part of a two-part panel discussion titled Civility in Politics. Last week, the panel surveyed the political landscape both nationally and locally, then addressed the question, why has civility in politics declined? While this week's panel looks to find common ground among various perspectives while promoting tolerance. Today's panel includes Democratic Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck from the Utah House of Representatives, Wayne McCormick, Professor of Law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, Lisa Michelle Church, attorney in private practice and community activist, and Patrick Reimer, a student at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. Moderating today's panel is Mark Button, chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Utah. Here's Mark Button.
This is our second panel in a series dedicated to civility in politics, or its lack thereof. And we want to think with you today about what civility is, what kind of value it is, and whether and how it might be promoted in our politics. Contrasting visions and tolerance leaves us to think about how might civil discourse be pursued in relationship to pressing contemporary political problems. We might think here from immigration and refugees to climate change and access to water, to healthcare and access to housing. In all of these domains, the very quality and condition of our discussion and our debate is very much a part of the issue before us. So it would be too easy to say that we're living in very uncivil times. There's a lot of things that could be said about our times, but that's among the things that could certainly be said about it. And we might then think about what are the realistic prospects for civil discourse in the pursuit of important common ground on questions of great public importance. So to kind of get us started, I just want us to think about the following question and invite responses to it. How do we begin to critically examine our positions? Is it possible to examine our positions without hearing from all sides of a question? And how might we equip ourselves to be able to do so in a way that's productive of meaningful political conversation with the possibility, remote as it might seem today, for the possibility of addressing these kinds of pressing social problems? Wayne, let's start with that small question with you.
I think the thing I would emphasize here is that the approach to civility, first of all, is already begun. We're here today. And I think that's important. There are meetings of this type going on all over the country. There are many, many, many people concerned about this phenomenon. And I tend to think of it as a middle ground between ideological extremes, which is where most of us really fall. If you think of the extremes on the left and the extremes on the right, we can come back to this later, they actually tend to do something called loopification. They end up being very similar to each other. And in between, there's the vast bulk of the populace, the citizenry, who's concerned to try and reach answers. And thinking people really don't reach answers based on ideology, they look at the answers they reach and maybe they gravitate to one ideology or the other. But we're here today talking about finding solutions. And if that goes on, we the people will reach solutions eventually. So I have great optimism. And it takes place right here, civic engagement, gatherings of this type all over the country.
Yeah, for me, civility is the ability to exchange ideas, and our democracy is built on a marketplace of ideas, so I don't feel like civil discourse is a zero-sum game. I'm willing to lose a few as win a few, and I'm willing to accept incremental change. So once I remind myself of those values, being able to engage with someone who strongly disagrees with me is actually interesting, and in answer to your question, can we really move forward without examining other sides? No. I think we have to examine other sides. And my grandpa always had a saying on his wall, there's three sides to every story, yours, mine, and the facts. So I believe in multiculturalism, and I think it's an interesting challenge today. A couple of things I use when I try and engage with people, and I am newly recommitted to engaging with people who don't always agree with me or see it my way. No ad hominem arguments, no hyperbole. I try very hard to think about it from their point of view and listen first before I talk. As a lawyer, that's hard because I want to get in and establish my point of view, but there's a lot of phrases nowadays that are going to tell you that incivility is afoot, like, with all due respect, or I don't mean to be rude, but, or I'm not a racist, but, and so I've tried to swear off all of those cues, and I feel very strongly that we can get past this particular moment because we all seem to be so newly committed to it. So I'm encouraged as well.
So I think for me, one of the things I try to do is I wait a minute or two before I reply to a post. And I, you know, social media has been such a wonderful opportunity for us to learn from each other, but I also think in many cases it is become a challenge for us as a community and as a society, because we don't have to sit next to a person and say, this is the way I feel about it, and look at them and know their experience and know where they come from and know why might what might drive their perspective. They are anonymous to us, even if we know them or we are friends with them. And so it's easier to pontificate or to react maybe negatively to something that someone has said, when we don't have that person-to-person engagement or we don't know them a bit more deeply. Things people say online frustrate me too. But what I often try to do if I feel particularly frustrated is I will type that, what I would want to be that post, out. Just to vent for myself on a piece of paper because I like to write and I'm a visual learner. So I write it out, I get it all out, I set it to the side. Then I come back few hours later. And then oftentimes it really isn't what I wanted to say, or I don't think it really elevates the discussion in terms of what was originally posted. And I can come up either with something else, having thought about it and contemplated a little bit. Or in the meantime, other people have taken advantage of the situation. But I do think we need to often take a breath and think about what we're going to say. We live too much in a world of ready, fire, aim. And all of us need to reconsider what that means in terms of raising the temperature in terms of good civil discourse and debate.
So I don't have too much to add, actually. I think that I really agreed with a lot of the points that were made here. I think the one that sticks out with me is this idea that it's not a zero-sum game. And that I personally am a member of the minority political party in Utah, the Democratic Party here. And I feel like in my roles and in my work here, if I didn't figure out good ways to speak with people who have a variety of different political opinions, I just wouldn't be very productive in my work and what I want to do. And so, you know, my first principle with everybody is to just try to listen to where they're coming from, understand their opinions, and then engage. I really, on a personal level with people, I find that I just have a lot more success when I am not in a position where it's adversarial, where it is this person wins over that person or something like that, but it's actually an exchange. And usually if I can get conversations to that point, then I can be a little bit more productive. You know, the other point I'd make is that civility is important, but, you know, incivility is also a value of this country as well. And it's a hard issue for me because I think that there's this healthy tension where you want people to speak out and say their views, and you want those messages to get across, and you want other people who maybe even aren't the immediate recipients of that message to think about that message and understand where they're coming from, or at least ruminate on it for a while. And I mean, you've seen that in a ton of different issues, and so it is this weird tension between these two sides where. You know, we want people to be able to express themselves. We also want to be able to hold the fabric of this country together, and that requires being able to listen as well. So,
that's Patrick Reimer, a student at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. And thanks for tuning in to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Today we are airing a panel discussion recorded on April 16th, looking to find common ground in American political discourse. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today, we're airing a panel discussion recorded on April 16th at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the perceived decline in civility within American politics, with an emphasis on finding common ground in an otherwise polarized world. The conversation was moderated by Mark Button, chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Utah, and panelists Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck from the Utah House of Representatives, Wayne McCormick, professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, Lisa Michelle Church, attorney in private practice and community activist, and Patrick Reimer, student at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. Here's Mark Button.
All else being equal, we might very well want to maximize decorum and civility in discussion. But things are not always equal, right? And so the question is, must we always be civil? What if the we in that question are marginalized persons subject to racial or sexual violence, stigma, shaming, and exclusion? Under these kinds of conditions, is civility always necessary? Is it even wise in political society? Here I might just remind you that Ida B. Wells, Martin Luther King Jr., were frequently derided by often white liberal moderates for themselves being uncivil. And Frederick Douglass, of course, in 1852, openly embraced what he called biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke as a way of trying to quicken feelings, rousing the conscience of a nation to the sins of slavery. And we might very well think that in certain conditions, civility is not a normative good. So I just invite the panelists to think a little bit about that and answer the question, must we always be civil? Is that always wise political counsel?
I'd like to take that on from the point of view when I was working on behalf of human services in the state. Most of the people that we served, thousands and thousands of people in Utah, did not have the same access or privilege that I did. And this came home to me when I was up in front of the lawmakers and I was advocating for their budget, and a lawmaker said to me, "Lisa Michelle, you don't have a constituency." And what he meant was, I don't hear from your constituency, or your constituency has no power. So I had to really think, am I too afraid of making him uncomfortable and I'm not advocating? And I'm a trained advocate, so I had to really critically examine that. To me, there are times when I had to say things that made the legislature very uncomfortable, and some of them would pull me aside in the hall and say, "Lisa Michelle, you're making me feel ashamed of myself, and I don't like feeling that way, so I'm not going to vote for your budget." And I'd think, wow, am I using the right tactics? But to me, civility is not the ultimate value. I think there are other values that are competing values, and I don't confuse civility with making people feel comfortable. I think there's a range in there, and I'm willing to explore it.
I think I would add to that, just kind of in light of the experiences that I've had when Lisa Michelle would come and testify in front of us, is that for me, I draw a distinction of allowing people to share their stories and their voice. And what we do have nowadays, oftentimes, is people trying to explain away or explain for other people what their experiences are. And it happens on both sides of the political spectrum. And I think that we shouldn't be doing that at all. We should let people own their own experiences and their own stories, because we as legislators and as policymakers, we often talk about we need the data, we need the information in order to make decisions. But we're okay with the hard data, but then when we look at the qualitative information, all of a sudden that's what makes us uncomfortable. And that colors the decisions that we make. And so I think there is always room for that. I have often found that I can present those stories and then complement them in a way that the person on the other side who may shut themselves to be tone deaf or just not listen to that in a way that they're willing to hear it. So I think sometimes, I guess the other thing too I would add is, I think there's a role for every type of advocacy and every type of activism. Mm-hmm. It is the myriad pieces of the tool set that we have to be able to affect change in our constitutional republic. We have all of these tools. We have activism, we have rhetoric, we have diplomacy, we have facts. And what I don't like to see is one sector say our approach is better than the other. There is room for all of it. There is need for all of it. You don't have a complete picture if you don't have the activists and people who feel strongly and share their stories. But you also don't have the motivation or the movement if the diplomats and the administrators and the policymakers and others are also not moving the ball forward. So that is more of what I often get frustrated by is, you're not doing it the right way. You're not doing it the right way. This is the way we should be doing it. There is room for all facets of advocacy and activism in order for us to move policy forward. And I think we need to embrace and support all of those elements.
Two thoughts occur to me from what was just said. One is to return to the earlier statement about not making ad hominem attacks. If you'll notice in the examples that Mark gave, the Martin Luther King and Frederick Douglass comments were about concepts, actions. They weren't about individuals. Occasionally individuals would come into the mix, but mm-hmm. for the most part, it was about pushing an agenda forward, which sometimes does require saying, this is what I'm reacting against. But most of the time, in that type of advocacy, you're pushing forward on a point. And I think that's what we're lacking right now. Because the other thing that has happened, and everybody here is aware of it, is that the social media, the internet, the speed at which misinformation as well as real information can go forward is now causing us to stop and take a deep breath if we really want to be serious about learning something. And that itself is a skill that I think really needs to be emphasized. So I would say civility is the norm. The incivility has to be the exception, or otherwise we fall into a new normal, and that's no good either.
I would just add a couple things. I think the internet's interesting. I think Facebook's kind of, I feel like we're all kind of growing up with Facebook. You know, it comes out, people get used to it, kind of, you write a million comments, you get super saturated with all these things, and we learn how to respond to some of it. I think I'm getting better at tuning out some of my weird relatives who maybe have some strange opinions on things, or just react really strongly to certain things. But I do kind of, sometimes I think of the internet like fast food. I feel like in the 90s, fast food hit us really hard and strong, and I feel like I ate many, many fast food meals growing up as a kid, and now I realize how awful fast food is for you, and I shouldn't eat fast food. But it took me a while to kind of get that I needed to slow down on that. And I think social media can be kind of the same type of thing, where it's a lot of information, it's immediately gratifying in some ways, and but we're starting to learn how to respond to it and train ourselves in response. You know, the other thing I just wanted to pick up on was this idea of incivility being punished in some of our public institutions. I always thought there was a weird irony when you'd hear legislators sometimes say, well, yeah, I'm not going to vote for this bill or not vote for this funding level because they came up here and they protested and they yelled for a really long time. And I always think, what did you think you signed up for? That's what people do. Like, people have issues that they feel that are real to them, and they're going to show up and they're going to express their opinions on things. And I think that the best legislators take it as one of the tools in the toolkit when they're analyzing, when they're making these decisions to try to balance all of these different interests, and don't kind of see it as a way to punish. So.
If I could just add a really quick thing, the thing that I always do as a legislator is I really try to focus on the policy and not the person. And I will say that not all of my colleagues approach things in the same way. They can be very sensitive and take things very personally when you vote against their legislation. And I have always looked at it as it's an issue of policy. You don't agree with me, and I'm not taking that as a personal affront. I think sometimes nowadays, especially when we're talking about policies and issues, people take it as a personal affront. And even if you try to tackle it at the policy level, and there's something to be said for, as we're in the last of the series here, there was a discussion about literacy, media literacy and engagement. And I think we also have to, and when we're looking at critical thinking, that we also have to learn to teach our students and ourselves to not take discussions and dialogue and dissent and debate as a personal affront, unless persons actually attack you. But I mean, if they're not attacking you, they're just attacking a policy or idea. It's not about you. It's about the policy or the idea. And I think that we all need to work. I need to work on it too. But I've always really tried to focus on the policy, not the person.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today we are airing a panel discussion recorded on April 16th at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on civility in politics, which sought to foster common ground in American political dialogue. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the audience.
Well, I think we're off to a good start here. Let's invite comments, questions, remarks from members of the audience. John Francis.
So my question to the four of you, I mean, the four of you are excellent examples of people participating in public life. But for the person five doors down, whose way of achieving or maintaining power is to trash another person, and we often hear that in the current climate, to what extent do we, me and all of you, have an obligation to call that person out who spends their life trashing others as a way of avoiding maybe dealing with the genuine policy issues that are before us?
For me, I have to decide what is the goal of the engagement. Sometimes I'm just making small talk with the person and they say something and I don't respond. Then another time there might be a serious exchange of ideas, which I hope I could have with that neighbor, and that would be heated, but it wouldn't be incivil. It would be the kind of thing where we would agree to disagree at some point. But I wouldn't hesitate to try talking at first with that person. There's another level, though, that becomes straight up argument. And I recognize that and I disengage because I don't think I've ever changed anyone's mind in those settings, no matter what I say or do. So it's really important to proportionally gauge what are you trying to accomplish with this interaction. And certainly if they sought me out, I would try my very best to put it in that category where I'm trying to engage in a way that affirms them, but also lets them see my conviction on the issue. And I'll tell you, one of the things you have to look at is whether or not you can sacrifice the relationship. That's really important. And in my business life, I've had several of these come up since the election where people, you know, knowing that I'm a Republican, will come and say this and this and this, and I'll have to decide, okay, if I say I don't agree with that, they're going to say this, and then where are we going to be? And it's a business relationship that I can't afford to lose. So really a contextualizing of what you're trying to accomplish. That's how I approach it.
I think that's critically important, Lisa, because in different walks of life, we have different roles that we play. And I think in answer to John's question, I immediately thought, what do you mean by call that person out? I don't have to name that person individually in some public setting. I can speak to that person directly. And once I am face to face with someone, then my role, my relationship with that person becomes a part of the mix. And how vigorously I say I disagree then depends in part on that role. But always bearing in mind what you're trying to do is accomplish a mutual understanding. And that's what civility is to me.
Two questions. I've had a lot of experience debating people in questions on public lands, for instance. And some of our legislators have a record that needs to be brought out. And generally, when that happens, there is a certain amount of heat, whether it's Mike Noel or some of the other folks who generally oppose what I have to say. What's your suggestion on how to deal where you're going to be bringing up an unpleasant fact, or is sarcasm part of civility?
I'll take a quick crack at that, Pat, because I have been in some of those same debates, as you know, and it seems that what I would hope we can do is somehow rise above that petty angst that these people portray. I'm a great believer in the power of positive thinking. I never read Bishop Sheen's book, but I remember it, the title of it. And the other quote that I was going to come back to, Mark, earlier was one that Mahatma Gandhi popularized, although it goes way, way, way back, that an eye for an eye ends up making the whole world blind. It's a very salient point here in our current climate that if we want to move forward, we've got to somehow rise above, is the way I think of it, and to push our positive points without I want to emphasize, sometimes you have to be uncivil to respond to somebody who is being uncivil. There's no question about that. We, all of us here, especially all the lawyers, we believe in law enforcement. We want the perpetrators of misfeasance to be called out in that sense, yes. But as I said earlier, I want it to be the exception, not the norm of debate.
I think the thing that I would add to it, too, again, in light of our last week's discussion, is relying on the role of the Fourth Estate to help us, to be that megaphone for concern, and to facilitate the information being shared. I don't utilize humor or sarcasm, but that's just my style. I'm not good at it. So I think if I were to do that, I would just come off as peculiar, for lack of a better way of putting it. But some people are really good at that. And so I think sometimes that's helpful to start the discussion, but I think that you also have to have an army of allies with different skills, and that, but like the Fourth Estate, people that are reporters, and so that it's not just one person against one person. I guess that's sometimes where I wonder if other people are catching on what the message is, if it just becomes a war of words between a couple of two or three or four people. There needs to be this critical mass of people saying, yeah, a person said that, but then I also read this article in the Tribune that reinforces that story or that concern. And then we have advocacy groups that are also doing that. So again, it goes back to variety of players in our society calling to account our public officials. But sometimes it does take one person to get that ball rolling.
If I may just add a quick comment about the Fourth Estate from last week's forum. Jennifer Napier-Pierce made a very important point, I think, that all of us, everybody, should be aware of, and that is pay for your news. Because the paid commercial advertising on the sites that we get to look at for free is not necessarily invested in the truth. The sites of the public media that we pay for, they need to know that their constituents are going to keep coming back. And so when we pay for the news, we get a better product.
I just want to add one thing to it. I would hope that we don't ever get to the place where civility gets in the way of truth. I think that ultimately democratic accountability, the marketplace of ideas, this functions on the notion of there being some true information out there. And connecting back to the previous question a little bit, I found that when that person is, the person who's maybe saying kind of untrue things or just lambasting another person for some opinion or something like that, I feel like the best way to approach it is to try to be as factual as you can. I remember multiple times during the debates last March about the homeless shelter and where the shelter would be, and the many, many town halls that many of us were in the trenches on, a lot of different things go around, and it's a really uncomfortable subject. Where you put a homeless shelter is an extremely personal issue. But I would kind of draw the line for myself at where facts were just blatantly being pushed aside, I felt like I needed to speak up. And that would happen very often when you'd hear one person talking to another person. It was and maybe the message they were communicating was just very, very off base from what the actual facts on the ground were. And I would insert myself there. And that's kind of, I've tried to use that measurement for myself because at least I can feel good about how I participate in that.
So to the point of ad hominem and Facebook, and at the national level, the Trump campaign and Cambridge Analytica, the tendency for the likes of Steve Bannon to identify culture wars as a way to drive wedges, to drive an agenda and attain success. We've got Trump in office. I think that Facebook, one of the issues there is that we do respond knee-jerk. We don't think. Many people don't think about the response. It is, as you said, Rebecca, ready, fire, aim. And so the key there is manipulation. I think that Cambridge Analytica presents an excellent case study in how, and this is not new, manipulation is used to attain an end result. And part of that is the ends justify the means or the other way around. I think we lose sight of that. So how do we, or not even a question as much as I think it is important to be aware of our sources of information and realize that a lot of what's being sent out is emotionally based. We're not thinking logically and rationally. Not us here in this room. We're probably all intellectually inclined. We're all here on a discussion of civility in politics. There are a lot of people in the world who don't have the time, inclination, or interest to engage in such a thing. So how do we get beyond this sort of isolated group and facilitate a society that deals logically, rationally, and gets away from emotionally, from emotions?
You just stole one of my questions, so let me add, that's a great question, and let's think about that question and think about, like, what's the role of leaders? What's the role of institutions, public institutions, higher education institutions, political institutions? I think that's a fabulous question for us to think
I'll
about.
I'll take a shot at it, because I felt very stung by Facebook, and then I decided I'm not giving up on it. I think there's a role for it, but it has to be very carefully curated, just like Jennifer said last week, and I mean, that could be a whole other discussion, but I've taken affirmative steps. I post once a month a political thing, but I do it in a way where I'm prepared for my strange relatives and my surprises. But I think the main thing is choose your battles. I really do, because I think if every single person in here chose three battles, likely they'd all be different ones, and it would be change right there. You know, we all get discouraged because the perfect is the enemy of the good, and we say, "Ah, can't use Facebook anymore, it's too dangerous." And I just say, no, we have to use every little tiny incremental thing we can, as long as we're staying true to our principles. And I wouldn't give up on that. You know, when I went up to the legislature on behalf of the child protection system, there's nothing more emotional in this state than parental rights. And I was going in on behalf of DCFS, and they were saying, absolutely not, you destroy families, this and that, before I even got my words out. And I ratcheted it back so far. All I ask was, give me the benefit of the doubt. Don't do anything else. I'm not even asking for one single thing. Just give me the benefit of the doubt. And that sounded pathetic, considering the stakes. But I had to do that, and honestly, it built a bridge over several years. It built a bridge where they would listen. So I don't think any step is too small. I don't get discouraged about that. I know what you're saying, but I refuse to be discouraged.
Yeah, I think that point that we each have different issues that we can pick up and carry forward is an important one. And I would also emphasize what Lisa just said about it takes time. It takes a lot of time. We feel like things are different today because of the speed of the internet, the echo chambers that people can get into. isolates them, it seems, from the rest of the world, but that's nothing new. Humans have been doing this for 5,000 years. They started out just talking to the people in their own cave, and then it was the people in their own tribe, and then it was the people, you know, and on and on and on. It's just that the speed and reach of the electronic communication makes it seem much more dramatic. But I, myself, don't engage in very active advocacy. I'm not an assertive, aggressive person, but I write my op-eds. Yeah. And sometimes they get published, and a lot of time they don't, so I just circulate them to other people. I don't use Facebook. It's just not my style. We all have different styles of communication, and I think that's part of what we're saying here today, is those different styles themselves will bring us together in a funny sort of way.
I also think we need to maybe reboot the system. I think that I've been working over the last few years, a couple of years actually, on looking at different mechanisms for elections reform and elections, period. I'm a very strong believer in ranked choice voting or other forms of proportional voting. I think that the system that we have currently has in some ways situated us to be as tribal and as bifurcated as we are, as ideologically bent as we are. There's a number of communities, cities, localities that have been using ranked choice voting for a number of years, and what they have found, the research has shown, that the campaigns are less hostile, they're less rhetorical, because the candidates have to appeal to a wider range of individuals. My biggest concerns about where we're going as a country in terms of elections processes is that the moderate middle has given up on the rest of us, you know, and I am a diehard progressive liberal Democrat, always have been, but I have always also looked to the numbers of unaffiliated voters that we have in this state, which is more than any of the other parties. And that says something. That tells us that people aren't aligned with party or ideology, they're aligned with values. And where you have seen this particular system implemented in communities, it has increased the voter engagement numbers. More people participate in elections, and it does diffuse the rhetoric, and it makes incumbents really uncomfortable, and that's okay.
Anything to add, Pat?
Yeah, just building on what Rebecca said, which I think is so incredibly important. And I think what worries me about civility or incivility is when it moves from, you know, I'm speaking out because I think this is the way that the institution will listen to me, which is part of the democratic design in this country. We expect people to speak out. But when it moves to, I'm speaking out and I might go do something else because I don't think the institutions will listen to me, I think that's where the big concerns start to come. And sometimes I think that actually even translates to what you see online, where you read some of these things or you see some of these things, and you kind of wonder in your head, you know, is anybody going to correct this? Is anybody going to address this? And I think for a long time we've relied on our institutions to help address some of those things and balance out these different concerns. But I think Representative Chavez-Hauck is spot on in terms of making sure that that back end, that when people are expressing their concerns, that back end of how people are elected, how this system works is responsive to those things. I think it's critical.
So I appreciate all those comments. I wanted to springboard off of something that you had said earlier, and that's this notion of truth and where this notion of truth sits with respect to civility. Say, for example, that we had a commander-in-chief who was fast and loose with the truth. Say that that was going on. Is he uncivil or incivil, whatever the word is? How do we hold that individual accountable? Does it matter if we hold them accountable? The last time I checked, politics isn't necessarily synonymous with the truth. So where does that notion or that morality sit? I think it's especially interesting in light of the Comey interview, which we've probably all seen the transcript. He's hitting on that head as well. How important should that be? And is it uncivil, then, to make an ad hominem attack like that leader is a liar or is not telling the truth? What do we do if we're in that hypothetical situation?
You know, it's funny. When I graduated, the graduation speaker here was David McCullough, but the runner-up speaker, I don't know how they title it, was a person named Spencer Kennard, and he was a Board of Trustees member. And I remember he gave this speech on the importance of seeking out truth in your life. And I never, at the time, I just thought, oh, that's an interesting thing. And then since I graduated, I feel like every week I've thought about this speech. And you know, I would say that, first off, I think that public servants have a duty to be truthful. And it's hard news to deliver, but they have a responsibility to be truthful. And I think you've seen that from some really impressive public leadership moves here. I think that Governor Herbert is a great example of somebody who, you know, faced with a member of the Republican Party who violates the law and takes an ATV into federal lands and looks for state assistance to fund incivility, draws the line and says, no, this is not something I can stand by. I understand the concern or whatnot, but I think our public officials have a duty to be truthful, and I think that we should expect that of our public officials as well.
I think that this is, as an MPA graduate, I think this is where administrators and civil servants really come into play in terms of protecting the institutions. Obviously, we want our public officials to be honest, and we do take a constitutional oath. Some of us are better at following it than others, but so do administrators. And so I think that the civil servants are the constant in these turbulent times. And you will see them, I've seen amazing examples over the past couple years, but even previously, of circumstances where you have a public official or the political bent of a particular administration go in one direction, and the ones that keep the lights on, that keep the programs going, are the administrators. And so, and unfortunately, they're under attack by so many people nowadays. But they're the ones that I see that are speaking truth to power in many cases at their own peril. So I think that there's roles for all of us to defend them, number one, by defending the institution. But I think that they are the constant, and I feel hopeful that we get through these ebbs and flows and these challenging times because we have people that are in the trenches doing the good work.
And one of the specific things I think is that Congress has to check the presidency and the courts have to check the others. And so we as voters need to tell our people in Congress that we expect them to be that balance. If we're not interested in the truth, they're not going to be. And that's kind of what I see right now, is that they don't feel like they need to stand up for the truth. There's some good exceptions in my party, McCain and Flake. And they say that they will stand up, but really the voters need to come forward and say, we're not going to tolerate it, and you're the check and balance, so act like it. That's where I see it.
Just a quick comment on that, because I think language also becomes important in this discussion. It is one thing to say that a statement is not true, that this person has said something not true. I even read rather carefully the Washington Post Pinocchio Awards just to see if I can then detect, make sure the Washington Post is being accurate. But it's a different thing to say that's a lie. Notice the difference in language there. I'm making a value judgment about that person's mental state when I say that that person is lying. They know that they're saying something untrue. And so I have to be careful with that. Where just saying something's not true, I don't have to be quite as careful. That's part of the civility in debate, I think, is being careful about the way we characterize the mental state of the other person.
So earlier somebody said, don't confuse incivility with making people uncomfortable. And I'd really love to hear you guys reflect on that, especially in the context of a university where either as educators or yourselves as students, we know that those moments of discomfort in the classroom when you're questioning your assumptions can be really great learning experiences. And so how do we manage that in the classroom? How do we promote that without wandering into this incivility territory that we're talking about?
Oh boy, I'm looking at my former students here and wondering. So I think that the intensity of debate on college campuses today has perhaps hit a peak. But maybe not. And the premise that I work from constantly is, again, back to the no ad hominem attacks. In the classroom, I will attack every idea, my own included. I try, hopefully, never to attack a person, and I try to prevent that from happening as well, among others. And when it does happen, we stop. We say, wait, okay, wait a minute, we're talking about this idea, this proposition? What can we say about the concept? In other settings, when there is a speaker coming to campus that people don't want to hear, I'm all in favor of just simply not attending, not giving them the benefit of that. But I want to pay attention to the thought before I do that. I want to make sure I hear what they're saying in some way, even if I express displeasure by voting with my feet, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's ground rules. I think you try and set up some ground rules, especially in a classroom setting or in a group. You know, there's things like don't use sarcasm or don't use ad hominem or nobody plays the devil's advocate today. Everyone just speaks their own truth. You know, there's logical things that you can agree as a group before you embark. And I think that's when it's worked the best for me, is when I have that open discussion up front and say, here's what we're going to do and here's where we're going. And now if we all abide by that, we're going to be okay.
I might add one thing and then we'll take one more question. Depending on how we define incivility, if incivility is tested by giving offense, I think that's going to be a pretty bad standard of incivility, because if an argument is pushed hard enough and enough counter evidence is provided, you're going to cause somebody offense. So I think we want to distinguish incivility from giving offense. From incivility as a manner of not respecting the moral standing and the dignity of another human being. When we do that, we're acting in ways that are uncivil, in a way that we can guard against, even in vigorous, challenging classroom environments or public environments. So here, a lot depends on how we configure incivility, I think.
In this current era, sometimes it feels like you want to be civil, but the system is rigged. And I'm curious about how we deal with things like gerrymandering and big money that's not reported. That makes the citizenry feel pretty insignificant when we're up against things like that. And so incivility seems like it's an option. How do you feel about that?
I think the main thing to realize about the system and the money is that the system is running on money and running very poorly, and we can call that out itself. I just saw something about the amount of money that one of the candidates in the Florida Senate race has already put on the table, an extraordinary amount of money to just win one election. And it's even happening now in judicial elections. So yes, the money, especially the dark money as it's called, is a huge problem. And that's one of the many issues on which the citizenry should be diligent and should be speaking out. We've mentioned gerrymandering, we've mentioned the money in campaigns, we've mentioned immigration, we've mentioned housing. Many, many, many issues deserve our attention, and that is clearly one major factor, is simply dealing with the money. And as a student of the First Amendment, I can speak out that I think a number of the Supreme Court cases are poorly decided. That doesn't mean they aren't the law of the land at the moment. We'll deal with it, and we'll keep advocating for other solutions.
One of my favorite quotes is, I live in a country that doesn't yet exist, but badly needs to exist. That's Vincent Harding. And I would just say, it still comes down to you and what you have the power to do, which in Utah, our elected officials are very accessible. You know, we do not live in California. We live in Utah, where I can get to know Rebecca at the legislature. And, you know, we've worked together for years. There's no excuse for not getting up there and getting to know them. And if you need to correct something, you hold your federal officials accountable about campaign finance, and gerrymandering is a local issue. And I just feel strongly that that comes back to what you're willing to do and what you're willing to commit yourself to do, even if it makes people nervous.
So this is such a hard question for me, because as much as I am a strong believer in voting, and all of this, a lot of the work that I've done in the legislature is elections reform and trying to take down every barrier possible. And I am a strong believer in ranked choice voting and the Fair Representation Act, which suggests that we move towards multi-member congressional districts, which I think would also make a difference. Systems reform is desperately needed. The challenge is there's still a number of people in our midst that depend upon and that are impacted by the decisions that we make as policymakers who are in the shadows. And so elections and voting is important, but we need to find a mechanism also to represent and to give voice to people in our community who are undocumented, who may be challenged for one reason or another, to be able to advocate on behalf of themselves that's where the rest of us step in, of helping them and assisting them in the many ways that we can, whether it's as an official administrator, whether it's as an advocate, or whether it is as a public official. We need to find some new ways of trying to give voice to the voiceless, and I think there's a lot of that happening. But I am a very strong believer in elections reform. I think that if we start to change the system, that will impact our inability and this stalemate that we've encountered in terms of affecting good elections reform related to campaign finance reform, and may get us moving in that direction as we start to make maybe some changes judicially.
I would just add a couple more thoughts to that, but in a former life, I spent a lot of time with my former professor mentor trying to fashion some different campaign finance policies that might work, and I've pretty much come to the point where campaign finance is such a hard issue to get people to care about when they're in the ballot box, when they're actually voting, that your moments of being able to reform the system are pretty rare. And so I've kind of come to the point where I feel like we do need to just see an amendment to the Constitution with respect to campaign finance. And that way, at least legislators can fashion something that will stick. I think the problem we might have is that you may see this political momentum to push for campaign finance reform as a follow-up to McCain-Feingold, or potentially, only to have the court strike it down. And so it's becoming such a fundamental aspect of our democracy, and it's playing such an integral role at this point that we just need to take that step as a country, and maybe more civil conversations on it will help, hopefully.
Well, thank you very much. Given this question, we might say that a lot of our politics today, either structurally or politically, seems to be incentivizing incivility. And if we're concerned about that, and if we're concerned in particular about the way in which civility can oftentimes be used differentially in our society by the powerful against the weak, that's an observation that goes back to John Stuart Mill in the 19th century, then we might ask ourselves what can be done about it. Some of the answers, I think, from this panel is that we have to hold ourselves accountable to these standards, and we have to do our very best in a democracy to hold our elected officials and our institutions accountable to those forms as well. One of the ironies, of course, is that the virtue of civility is often applied in very different ways and in unequal ways. And indeed, it's oftentimes a sign of political courage that we use to applaud our leaders who, using uncivil invective, are applauded for using honest zeal, righteous indignation, or telling it like it is. And somehow we've transformed a virtue into a vice. If we're paying close attention to that, I think all of us, equipped with some of these things we've talked about today, can begin to turn that around, hold our leaders accountable in a democracy that's at least the very least that we are required to do. With that, I just want to very much thank all of our panelists for this very thought-provoking, intriguing discussion. We really appreciate your participation. Please join me in thanking all of them for their contributions.
That's Mark Button, Chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Utah. You can find a full recording of this panel, which sought out to find common ground from various perspectives, at our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thank you for listening.